Popcorn Junkies.
Hello, welcome,
welcome to Popcorn Junkies.
Popcorn Junkies. Here we are. This is a review of Saltburn.
Which, for some reason, I keep wanting to call Burntwood, which is a book by Sarah Horton.
Oh, is it? Burntwood. Yes, Saltburn. Yes, Saltburn. This Saltburn. Is a film by, I know we disagree on the pronunciation, but Emerald Fennell?
Fennell.
Or fennel. I mean, I like to call it fennel because I like to think she's a semi-precious stone, or a precious stone, and a herb. She directed Promising Young Woman, which was the Kerry Mulligan film, which I thought was a really... I think I preferred it to you. I liked it more than you.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really interesting sort of feminist revenge thriller that didn't go for the obvious choices, which I thought
it didn't. And maybe I didn't get those choices, but I did like it, but I didn't like it as much as you guys did.
But it was a bit, I would say, lumpy. This is a film that stars Barry Keoghan, who we all know from Banshees of Inisherin. He was also in American Animals.
Sacred Deer.
Killing of a Sacred Deer. He was also in American Animals. And he's also the not really seen very much Joker in the new Batman. So he has played the Joker. It also stars Jacob Elordi, who we would know from Euphoria. He's also soon to be seen in Priscilla, playing opposite Priscilla, playing Elvis. I didn't realise he's an Australian actor. I thought he was an American
actor. I don't know him at all because I haven't watched...
Euphoria.
But I think he's amazing.
Essentially, they're the stars of the piece. It also stars Richard E. Grant is in there. It also has Rosamund Pike in there too. Kerry Mulligan has a little cameo in there somewhere too.
The other important one is the cousin. I don't know what his name is.
Yes.
I mean, he has almost as big a part as those two, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. Okay, so what is this? I mean, we've seen the trailers. It feels like it's one of those films that sits within the sort of Brideshead Revisited, Another Country, Maurice, Morris, those films, sort of, Oxbridge, the spires, the churches, the turrets, academia, all that kind of stuff, isn't it? And the posh. It's basically, it's about the upper classes.
They even mentioned Evelyn Waugh at one point in the script. Did you catch it?
I did, yeah.
It was only said very briefly and moved on, but Evelyn Waugh loves his house or something.
So Barry Keoghan plays a young aspirant undergraduate, goes to Oxford. He's clearly, it's denoted quite quickly and quite easily that he's out of his league. He's culturally, economically, socially, he's from Liverpool, Merseyside. He's not cut from the same cloth, as everyone else in Oxford. And so the first act, if you like, of this film is very much a sort of, it's entrenched within the academia of Oxford, isn't it? And the establishing of him as a sort of, at this point, quite humble, quiet, sort of, trying to kind of make strides into this world, wanted to make connections, a bit of a loner, a bit of a loser, a bit sad. Yeah. He's doubled up with the sort of maths geek. It was that very funny moment at the beginning.
Right. He's read every book on the book list when nobody ever does, and all of things like that, which I've so felt for him.
Which was funny. And so, how did you feel about this front end before we get towards the later acts? This front sort of establishing of him and Jacob Elordi as amongst the other students, and
This is the part of the film that I like the most, actually, the beginning, the establishment of things. I love Barry
Obi-Wan Kenobi. I love Barry Kenobi.
But I love
Barry Keoghan.
The tall lad, Jacob, what was it?
Jacob Elordi.
Even more.
Jacob Elordi was really impressive.
I thought he was absolutely... And also, he's playing such a difficult character. He's playing sort of an upper-class twit, but who's actually nice. It seems to be, anyway, and sort of is genuinely sort of good. So what I found problematic, because it starts with a voiceover.
Yes.
And the very first thing that he says is, I didn't love him. Well, I did love him, but I wasn't in love with him.
And what did that do for you? Did that sort of set you off on the...
Well, I thought it was afterwards, as things went on and got slightly weirder and whatever, I thought that was a way out for the director, I thought, because
a way out of what?
Well, I felt the film was very, whatever the opposite of unbrave is, I felt it was not a brave film at all. And I felt partly the voiceover at the beginning was leading up to telling us that don't think that he was like this, because he really wasn't, without it meaning a damn thing. I mean, it sounds good and we're watching him and we think, oh, we know what we're in for, sort of an infatuation and all of that, except does become much more than infatuation. I thought it was lazy. You know, my favourite word.
But that was a conclusion you came to presumably after you got to the end of the film. It's a weird film on the one in terms of genre. It's a comedy. There's a lot of laugh out loud moments. There's a lot of humour. There's some nice, really. It's not brilliantly written all the way through, but there are some really nice comedic moments. Partly, I think, because of clever performance as well as clever lines. Really, the comedy for me pivots around the sort of almost the emotional, the lack of any emotional complexity or intelligence within the upper echelons of people. I thought, you know, a lot of the comedy was at that expense, like, oh, they're so sort of throwaway about someone's death or throwaway about someone's mental health and throwaway about, you know, what's happening to someone and dismissing people so quickly. And, you know, this kind of currency of kind of judging people and using people and deciding that someone was sort of superfluous or not important or culturally insignificant, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of humour around that, which I thought was good. In that first act. And I think what she was doing, the director there, was trying to ignite many different kind of possible narrative outcomes for us. She was trying to confuse us purposefully, you know, is a reflective sort of obituary of a loving relationship, or this is a young sort of lost boy trying to kind of, you know, ingratiate himself into a culture. So I actually found the first hour, and I think that monologue or voiceover at the beginning helped to create quite a bit of confusion for me, because I didn't quite know where I thought this was going to go. It became quite sort of, it was almost like a puzzle.
It was.
And
I
liked
that. It did hit me with full force at the end of the film, obviously, but while it was happening, I knew it was her way of somehow getting us to think something that wasn't true.
You felt the hand of it too heavily.
In a safe place by doing it, if you know what I mean. I thought the writing was awful,
right,
of the whole film, and I agree with you to say it was funny, but the funniness was all one-liners. It was one-liners which were great and carried on almost until over halfway through the film, when suddenly it's not so funny anymore. Mm. But that's all they were. There was no sort of depth in the writing. Mm. Except that we know that, you know, he comes from a poor background, and we know that the other lad doesn't, comes from a rich background, and there's that.
Well,
we don't really know anything else.
No, and also what happens is, I mean, Barry Keane's character is a liar. I mean, basically, it's revealed to us. This is a spoiler review, by the way. And so, but I mean, what we discover is that he's basically been spinning yarn, a bit of a Walter Mitty, you know, what I liked about that as a kind of idea within a sort of, if you like, university kind of era, you know, something set within the coming of age of a university. When people go to university, everyone does that. Everyone wants to reinvent. Everyone wants to sort of artificially create this narrative around themselves. I pretended I'd cycled all the way from London, and I couldn't have done because I had a suitcase.
Yeah.
You know, people want
to... You talked about this, I think, in the trailer. Yeah, review,
and
I think it's a really good thing to talk about.
And I think it's a really important part of the film, because the film is about reinvention, where reinvention becomes kind of psychopathic, and where you can lose track of who you are or what you are in a desire to have something that was never really rightly yours in the first place. And I think that's what the film becomes. I mean, I suppose just sitting in this first hour, though, I really enjoyed the first hour.
I did. The first act. I thought it looked gorgeous.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it really did.
I thought
they were both great.
I did too. If anything, I actually thought the other guy was even better than Barry, because he was such a sort of newbie to me, but also I thought a difficult part to play and for us to believe it.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
I mean, Barry Keoghan is more sort of hard-faced, isn't he?
I read someone describe him as looking... Barry Keoghan, is it Keoghan? Has the capacity to look like a feral animal that both you could stroke and it will also kill you.
Yeah,
you know, it might attack. You'll cuddle up, exactly, and you don't know which way it's going to go. But you're right. I think the big surprise in this front hour was how much I found the film did a really good, successful job of parking me alongside Barry Keoghan. I bought into this idolation of this guy. I fell in love with him. I was swooning for Jacob Elordi.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it would be impossible not to, really.
Yeah, it was lovely
in a way.
Yeah, he was self-effacing. He helped him out of that financial moment in the pub. I mean, all of this, there's a big twist that comes in this film. There is big twists in this. There are big moments. There are big surprises. That's all I would say. And so in a weird way, so this is a film of, there are three acts, but there was very much this long, elongated front.
Yeah.
And then there's this moment where really Barry Keoghan doesn't want to go home. He wants, and so Jacob Elordi says, come to Saltburn. So we go to Saltburn, and Saltburn is this huge palatial, you know, landed gentry. Evelyn Waugh once went there. Napoleon's chess set was in a corner, potentially, all that kind of stuff. And so you have Barry Keoghan, in, you know, parked, his character parked within a world absolutely not of his not his comfort zone. And then
and it was
really...
still going great at that point.
Yes,
I thought,
it was.
She then introduces us to this cast of characters, which were all brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, Rosamund Pike, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, talk about her. What did you think of Rosamund? I thought she was fantastic.
She was fantastic. I always quite liked her, but after that film, I really, really rated her. She was brilliant.
I mean, Richard E. Grant was absolutely sort of airhead. I mean, he was very good because I've met people like this landed gentry, you know, almost simple.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, mentally quite challenged and yet still parked within this world and sort of forever everything's new and everything's curious and everything's odd. And
I feel that the cousin as well can't be underrated because it's his sort of...
He's like Iago, isn't he?
He is, or to use this sort of thing, which I don't think you like my insistence on the talented Mr. Ripley, but he plays do you know the character who doesn't believe in what's happening to Ripley?
Yes,
I know. Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he's sort of, he gets more and more, we see more and more of him sort of brooding and the intensity of him, hatred, I suppose. It sort of builds, doesn't it?
Well, at this point, listeners, viewers, obviously the film's about to come out. This is proper spoiler territory now. So if you don't want to stick with us for any longer, go away, watch the film, and then come back at this point. Because then the film shifts. And as the film shifts, it shifts towards this idea that actually Barry Keoghan is not the little victim or the poor soul or the lost soul. He's got much more sinister ambitions. He's laying the groundwork for all sorts of kind of hijacking of situations, destruction. He's obsessed, obviously, with Jacob Elordi, but the obsession that he has with him is both sexual and quite repulsively sexual in some ways. I thought there were a couple of moments that I could have really done without. Thinking of him licking the plug hole of a bath after Jacob Elordi has masturbated in it was a step.
Yeah.
A step, I don't know.
It
kind of didn't work for me. And I think what's weird about this film was it started to teeter towards, and I this is what I was expecting it to do. It was going to teeter towards what I would call almost a sort of Regency horror. I thought, you know, in the setting.
We
were going to sort of head towards, the dark underpinning of upper classness and affluence. And, you know, in the trailer, I think I was saying things like, I wonder if we're going to discover they're masons and they want to eat them. And then there's all this. And in fact, what's surprising about this film, spoiler, is all of the malevolence comes from Barry.
Yeah, it's true.
I genuinely didn't see that coming.
No, nobody saw it coming because he gives a get out at the beginning saying he wasn't in love with him and he loved him, but everybody loved him. Mm. I mean, that sentence becomes more and more echoing through the film as it goes on because everybody loves him, doesn't it? Rosamund Pike says it. She says, you know, you always introduce us to people. You're so kind, Felix, you know, but he might have been terrible.
But he does a clever job of wrongfootedness because on the one hand, all of this posh family is saying, he's just like the last one you had, or the sister, you know, the sister with the eating disorder.
Or slightly better than.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a dreadful thing. Yeah,
horrible,
yeah.
Horrible. So you feel this kind of disposability that he's not even a person. And you've even had Carey Mulligan, who's obviously not dissimilar, has just been there for a while and they want her to go and they tell her to go. Mad as a hatter. And she kind of goes. And in fact, off camera, something awful happens to her. And they're so sort of matter of fact, you know, there she goes looking for attention again. You know, when the news comes through that something's
Like, I don't know if you remember Rosamund Pike's definition of why she was turned off lesbianism. Do you remember that phrase?
Oh, goodness, what was it? It was awful, wasn't it?
It was all too moist.
It was all too wet.
It was wet.
Yeah. I mean, there were some good lines. As I say, there's some laugh
out loud. Good one-liners. Now, as we are into the second stroke, third act, because it sort of goes into it, doesn't it, the third act, I started to have trouble with not... I mean, I love Barry Keoghan. I love him. He's my favourite actor of all time. Mm. I felt, and it wasn't his fault, I felt he wasn't being given enough words to do anything with them. His looks, fine. His looks, he's got a look, but that can always be interpreted as either threatening, like you said.
Yeah.
He can either be kind or he can be sort of...
cuddly or fierce.
Not kind, yeah. But increasingly, it became sort of like... he's doing these, let's just say, bizarre things. And there's no explanation. Except that we have this sort of key scene where we discover, as you said, that he is a liar because he's told these stories about his parents being dead
or an alcoholic.
Jacob
Elordi, classic bit of rumbling where he says, let's go and see your parents.
Yeah. Which is, yes, that was the first time I started to see that he'd got a different agenda as
Exactly.
And,
Yeah, but even Jacob Elordi. So it is clear. I mean, as I'm describing it, I'm thinking it did its job. So we thought Barry Keoghan was one thing. We thought Jacob Elordi was another. It slowly turns, although it doesn't slowly turn. There was a really, for me, a horrendous gear change at the point where Barry Keoghan is sitting there and he's saying to Rosamund Pike, "You're beautiful." And you suddenly, it was almost like they may as well have had sort of string orchestra going. It was like such a corner turn. And quite literally upon that scene, he went from, you know, sort of lost, not good enough, trying to fit in, you know, out of his league, trying to kind of get Jacob's kind of attention, to just becoming almost the arch villain of the piece. And I thought it was a little bit too obvious. I found there was a lack of subtlety in his gear change.
You said it. That's what I was trying to think of a phrase that I felt so much in it. There was a lack of subtlety altogether.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of putting it down to the writing. And she gets away with it for the first two thirds because there is a one-liner, a very funny one-liner, delivered beautifully by a strong cast. Mm. And so you laugh, and increasingly they're more and more outrageous, so you laugh even more. Mm. But I do remember, I didn't say it to you in the cinema, but I did think not long before the end, we haven't laughed now for quite a long time.
No.
She sort of somehow stops.
No, and we hadn't laughed, and I hadn't found any of the sort of twisted sex particularly inventive or clever. It was pretty predictable. It was kind of gross and unimaginative, I thought, as well.
Yeah, I mean, the scene which was also, I mean, they're all key scenes, I suppose, from then on, where he sort of seduces, or she seduces him, the sister.
Yes. It didn't work for me.
It didn't work for me, and I felt in that moment, for various things, which subs will see when they see it, she was trying to be more outrageous than she could possibly be, the writer and director.
Yes. Yeah.
She was trying to say, you know, this is outrageous, and it was, but not nearly as much as she thought it was.
No, absolutely. I agree.
And that's sort of like, we start to realise that Oliver, his name's Oliver, isn't it? Is it not Oliver Twist? It can't be Oliver Twist.
Oliver Twist.
Barry, there's more to him than meets the eye.
Yeah, there's a lot more to him than meets the eye. And so
he goes for that, doesn't he?
He does go for it. And I also didn't necessarily think that the way in which he sort of continued to inveigle his way alongside Rosamund Pike and keep himself close to Richard E. Grant and embedded in the family, I didn't even think that was done particularly cleverly either. So I didn't entirely buy into how he suddenly had all of their attention and all their loyalty and all their sort of, you know, trust in a sense. You know, he'd managed to get their trust. And then what happens towards the end of this film is quite ghastly, is that it becomes a sort of serial killer kind of thing. You know, it's like one by one, we witness members of the family just kind of becoming, you know, die.
Dead.
Yeah, I mean, there's no two ways about it. And there were moments in that which should have worked or been funnier. So, for example, when a key character, there are lots of spoilers here, I'll try not to spoil that bit, but when one key character who has died, and they're all sat round the table and they pull the curtains to, It missed its target, that, with the comedy.
Yeah.
You know, they were trying...
Yeah.
I couldn't work out what this film was trying to say about being rich and about the upper classes. I couldn't work out if it was trying to lampoon the world for being so disconnected from the real world that they didn't even understand the value of life versus death. I think that was probably in there. But they, you know, did they deserve what was happening to them because they were so sort of almost privileged that they felt nothing? So, you know, when Kerry Mulligan's character vaporizes off camera, you sort of think, God, they're cold, they're callous, they're harsh. You know, what were we led to think? I literally couldn't work out what this film was trying to say. Now, it doesn't need to be saying anything, but
it does really when she's giving you what she's giving you visually.
I think you're right. I think it does.
It does. That's when I sort of, I mean, there's a scene with the sister, which is, I mean, I suppose that's just par for the course these days in films, but it's slightly on the edge. You could tell she was starting to slightly want to shock us, the director. Mm. Then you've got the bath scene, which is
we're talking about the moment where she was on her period. Yeah, so we've got period blood.
So vampire. I mean, she herself, the director, has said it's a vampire film, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Which, to me, speaks of how silly she is. No.
Yeah, maybe.
But I mean, maybe what could you say for that?
Yeah.
But
I mean, it is a horror. I think it's a class horror film. It's a sort of it's a period. It's not period drama, but it's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of stately home horror film. I mean, and it's about. See, for me, I ended up coming out of this film thinking, because what was really odd about the final act was, whether you thought it all worked or didn't all work, or some of it worked better than other bits, it then kind of, and it was long, it was 2.5 hours long, you know, in the last half hour, even though it was a long film, she really wrapped it up rapidly. It felt so hurried at the end, like she wanted to quickly get us to the end of whatever this sort of shaggy dog story was, or this kind of joke was. And I think it dealt with so many potentially deep things. It's not that it needed to become a deep emotional film. I found it really quite disengaging because once we'd lost the Barry Keoghan who wanted connection and desired connection, once he sort of revealed his true colours and he was more Machiavellian, and because Jacob Elordi then sort of distanced himself at that point, I felt there was no really sort of warm human heart anywhere
in this
film.
No heart to the film. No. I absolutely agree with that. Absolutely agree with that.
And I don't think that necessarily means there has to be for a film, but I think there does somewhere.
There does. I know I'm making a big deal of this voiceover at the beginning, but a bit of me thinks she looked at the finished film and thought she had to add something at the beginning.
It's a device
almost explain to us something, because she goes from nothing to sort of, 100.
I mean, I was feeling so many different things. I felt like it was a classic film of the ultimate con man. It was a film about a swindle. What was he swindling? What did he want? Did he want the life? Did he want the family? Did he want the connections? Did he want the wealth?
Did he just want to punish them?
Or did he just want to hurt them? And I think whilst all of those things are great, rich things to wonder, I do, like you said, I do think the film needed to kind of press one of those levers a bit further for us to feel that that's what it was going for. Because in the end, it's almost like it threw everything at the wall and didn't sort of pin its colours to any mark. I'm using lots of metaphors here, but then it involves lots of things flying.
I agree.
Do you know what I mean?
Agree. Yeah. Just to go back for a second, did you like the way it looked?
I thought it was beautifully shot. I did like the way it was shot. I thought there were certain scenes and sequences that just lost focus massively. And like, for example, the huge long party scene out of which huge tragedy emerges. You know, I thought it was quite unimaginatively done, the party.
Yeah, and then I saw a review somewhere saying it was just astoundingly incredible. And I thought, well, maybe I don't know.
Put it this way, I'm hoping to shoot something slightly better than that in Hackney in December.
Exactly. But, I mean, there were some nice sort of shots where they shoot people against mirrors and glasses. But then again, that's in every film these days as well. You've got to work very hard to be different.
I think I was perhaps a little bit disappointed. I felt a little bit led up the stately garden path. And believe me, it's a long stately garden path. I quite like the detail of that he didn't arrive in a car and he didn't leave in a car. He had to walk. I quite like that. I mean, there are lots of things that... I tell you what I ended up thinking this film was. You know how most horror films, or social horror films, you know, most horror films are about a sort of social concern or a deep-bedded, unarticulated fear. Maybe it's misogyny, maybe it's fear of woman, maybe it's fear of the vagina, you know, all these things. Where is the horror situated? And for me, I wondered whether in the end, and I think this is a disappointing summary, because I think there's so much more in this film, and this film could have been so much more than this.
It was disappointing, though. That was my first word when we came out. It depressed you, didn't it? But
I want to get to that in a minute. No, but I wonder whether what this film ended up being, which then makes it quite quickly dismissible, unfortunately, is this just the, in a sense, the idle worst fears of a rich person? That someone ordinary could come in and inveigle their way in and take everything. So was this film actually an articulation of the upper class's sort of deep, hidden, subconscious fears of losing their wealth? And that is kind of interesting because, you know, is she rich enough that she comes from that level of kind of aristocracy? I don't know. But, you know, it didn't...
Emerald,
the director. But even that, if that's its theme, it didn't even kind of have the courage to go there in a way that almost... What's that other film with Tilda Swinton's daughter in it? The one where she's a filmmaker.
Oh, the girl who's done two films with the same name, isn't
it? Yeah. I can't remember what's that called?
No, I can't either.
But, you know, I mean, that's about being a rich kid who's privileged.
It is. School and all of this business.
But that made no sort of apologies for being sort of quite self-indulgent and wealthy, and this is a kind of middle-class, upper-class sort of thought.
And also, I've had all my criticisms of that girl. I wish I could remember her name. I can't. Yeah. But she at least told the story straight. She didn't sort of try to hide it by it becoming a sort of genre film, which in a way this veered on the edge of horror and various things, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was strange. It's a very strange film. But pushing beyond that, before we sum up and score it, other thoughts in there. Some, again, as I say, there were horrific moments, but they weren't horrific enough and not really horrific in the right ways for me. I think there was an attempt at really sort of grisly, sort of taboo humour, and I think it missed. I think it really, I think it really missed on that, especially with the, as you say, the scene with the sister and the period, being on a period, and the plug hole, and, you know, metaphors. And there was another moment where a lot of gyrating of naked body on a freshly dug grave didn't work for me, you know. These quite obviously shocking moments didn't work. They kind of missed whatever their target was. Now, that doesn't mean they weren't performed well or they weren't shot well, but they didn't land in the right way.
No, that's absolutely true. And I started to feel, and this is far more like, I do like a plot. Well, I don't like a plot in this case, but I felt that the whole film experience by that director with that cast was trying to bully Barry Keogh and his newfound fame and the fact that he's Irish and the fact that he's working class.
Oh.
And he said to her, this is totally in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a friend once who said, Di, you can't always have problems with the upper class.
Right.
They're people too, and that's probably true. But she gives him something to do at the end, Emerald, Barry, which I think, I'm sure, he did it with gusto, not with gusto, but it's sort of like he did it as if he was saying, well, I'll go with that. I'm not that happy, but I'll do it.
Right.
You know which scene I'm talking about.
Right.
Obviously.
Yes.
And I thought, that's not fair somehow, because this lad is a cracking actor.
Oh, so you think the film, in a sense, by asking him to do some of the things they asked him to do, was doing the very thing that we thought that family was doing by sort of almost humiliating the lackey, the servant.
Exactly, exactly. Ooh. And I had to really talk to myself. Blimey. I said, don't be ridiculous. I mean, he can go and do what he likes.
If Barry Keane sees this, he should maybe give you some money for psychotherapy, because, I mean, suddenly he'll discover he's been sort of used and abused.
I've said that, though, because it's been a while since we saw it, a couple of weeks, hasn't it? And I've kept thinking, oh, God, if I say that to Mark, he'll think I'm really weird.
I think I was hoping it would be a little bit more sophisticated in its darkness.
Yeah.
I thought, you're right. I think where it was funny, it was very funny. I think the delivery of the single lines, and they were one-liners, it's written by her too. You know, she's obviously a great talent, and I loved The Promising Young Woman. And there were lots in this that I liked. There were lots of moments. The front hour, I found it really escapist. I was really,
I did too.
And I bought into it. I really liked the Barry Keoghan before the turn, interestingly. And I could have even settled with a film that was about unrequited love and not belonging.
Yes.
It was weird, because I'm a great fan of going towards genre stuff and making things dark and twisted. But weirdly, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, I could have been quite happy with a film that didn't go that way with this, and that was a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
Maybe a death did happen. Maybe he was involved, but in a more subtle fashion. It didn't really have the courage of its convictions to just play for the emotional truth. So it ended up getting more and more ridiculous and outlandish. And then,
sense,
even the family, even the rich family, so Richard E. Grant and Rosamund Pike, they became less and less effective as they became more and more of a sort of cardboard cutout of no emotion and no engagement and no...
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And I sort of felt as well that... the reason I keep mentioning The Talented Mr. Ripley is that some people could say, oh, that's just a film about the poor people envying the rich. And so they...
Yeah.
But the character of Ripley, because it's written by a spot-on author, is so needy and so this and so that, and so that you believe it and you're taken with it.
Yeah.
And I know, we all know Barry could do that standing on his head, but he wasn't given it to do.
And that's a really good point that you've made, Mum, and that's really interesting. And that is about character development. This isn't it's less about script and story, but this is about character development. And what they actually...
I knew you'd know, yes.
Well, no, but also what you've said there, because if you think about it, the other thing that this film does, the director does, to get her out of this kind of, if you like, this dead end that she was in, they did that curious thing where they retrod the narrative of the film like a whodunit. So the moment with the cash, there wasn't even the subtle ask of us to think after the film, oh, I wonder if I go back and look at all these things, I'll pick up on that. You didn't need to go back and literally see the money in his wallet. If they'd done it in a more subtle and effective way, we would have reflected on it and thought, oh, he was leaving himself to look vulnerable and needing help. But she literally gave... Do you remember there was a moment where you got six shots of each moment and it was like, oh, who done it?
Yeah.
Oh, he actually did put this in the thing, and he put that on the thing, and he did the thing around the back. And
that
I think that reduced... That reminded us or highlighted how unsophisticated the plotting and character development was.
Exactly. And I really felt that sort of, I don't know, you know, when they do films and God knows how long it took to film, but on the last day of shooting or something, when that last scene was maybe considered and she told Barry, and Barry sort of maybe thought for a minute and thought, oh, I'll just go with it, go with it.
His naked dance.
His
naked dance. I mean, it does a naked dance at the end. I mean, it's, you know, it didn't even go
very
punk.
Sort of, very lackadaisically, but that works. I mean, he can make anything work with his face alone.
I think it would make a really interesting double bill with something like The Favourite, because in a weird way, The Favourite, which wasn't interested in going for horror, was inherently more horrific in its characterization. If you think of the Olivia Colman Queen, and if you think of Rachel Weisz and all those characters, Emma Stone, you know, it shows that the character development in a film like that, you know, because I'm thinking of something that has that, it had a similar sort of punk feel to it, didn't it? Although this is kind of only set in the 80s or 90s, this had a punk feel. The soundtrack was good. The soundtrack was interesting. Okay, well, how would you score it then, Mum? Blimey.
Yeah. 42.
Wow. Okay, really low. Really quite low. That's interesting.
And that's for the two main actors, really. Mm. Certainly not the writing.
Yeah, you see, for me, I think I was fully engaged, fully invested for a huge first hour. I even enjoyed the sort of first half hour that we were at Saltburn. And then at the point that Barry Keoghan's kind of intent was revealed, and it was pretty obvious, I was quite disappointed by how they almost, it was like in a game of poker, he just showed his whole hand in almost a moment, or certainly within a scene. Yeah. I could have done with being held back and not knowing. I'd have rather been more uncertain towards, for much longer in the film, towards the end. And then I felt it just really raced along in trying to kind of tie up these narrative holes. And they weren't really narrative holes. It was character holes. So you just sort of...
I just felt
characters were being dragged rapidly towards a destination that none of them really had getting to naturally. So it's really hard for me to score this, because on the one hand, I really enjoyed the first hour. And then the thing that I haven't said yet was I actually found it deeply depressing, because I thought... I came out of this film and it really threw me into a dark place.
It did, didn't it?
And the dark place, without going into the details, was a sort of, it made me reflect on people I've known. It made me reflect on, and I think the thing that depressed me about it was its absolute, by the end, lack of any heart or compassion or warmth in anyone. Frightened me. I always find it slightly alarming and frightening that where's emotion here? And so I found that a little bit unsettling. Like, you could argue maybe that's what the director was after. That's the horror of the film, perhaps. You could say that. I think I'd be more favourable than you. I think 42 is a bit too harsh for me. I'd probably give this 58.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Around the middle.
Yeah, around the middle.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting, though. She's a fascinating filmmaker.
Tell us what you think, Subs.